a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
Hi, folks. This is Jack Spirico with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, a man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things that we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is August the 9th, 2013, and this is episode 1183 of the Survival Podcast. And today is Friday, and that means it's time for your calls to 866-65-THINK. Again, 866-65-THINK. And for those of you without little letters next to the numbers on your phone, the number is actually 866-658-4465. 866-658-4465. Now, if you call that number, you're not going to hear, "Hey, caller, you're on the air with Jack." You're going to hear a voice message and you're going to leave it, and you might be on the air next week or the following week or what have you. And that's the way we run things here, because this is a podcast, not live radio, which means one show one day might be an hour long, and a show like today might go an hour and a half, an hour and 45 minutes long with no commercial interruptions. Just a little bit of housekeeping here at the beginning of the show, like always. On that note, sponsor of the day number one today is ReadyMadeResources.com. All the resources you need, ready-made, ready to go. Point, click, and buy from their website sent directly to you. And I mean all the resources you need, ready-made, ready to go. From tactical to practical, from guns to gardens to long-term food storage and everything in between, you'll find it all at ReadyMade Resources. Check them out today at ReadyMadeResources.com. Next up after that, BulkAmmo.com. Bulk Ammo is where you get the other precious metal, copper jacketed lead. Yep, that's right, copper jacketed lead, the third precious metal. That is the component of what I call the weapons operator triangle, and you have to have to go with the other two to make you effective as a gun owner. The first one is a gun. No gun, no effectiveness. Second one, training. No training, you can be moderately effective, but not as effective as you need to be. And the last one's ammo. Training, gun, no ammo, you're hosed. And to train, you need ammo so you can run the gun and train with. So you need more ammo than you just need for self-defense or even for hunting. You've got to have training ammo, and you've got to have ammo stocked up in case there's something like, oh, I don't know, ammo shortage. You check out bulkammo.com, and they will hook you up with lightning fast shipping, great availability, and a huge selection of the most common calibers. Check them out today, bulkammo.com. Remember that both Bulk Ammo and Ready Made Resources do have programs in the Member Support Brigade that offer you discounts. Check it out before you order from either one of them. That you'll find that on the benefits page of your Member Support Brigade account if you are an MSB member. Next up, I want to remind you guys about the TSP Gear Shop. Check out TSP Gear. We have some really cool stuff there. The offerings are always kind of being expanded a little here, a little there. Really cool stuff, some awesome t-shirts, tools, and patches, and other cool things. TSPgear.com to get your Survival Podcast stuff. Last but not least, do consider joining the Member Support Brigade. If you do that, you get exclusive content available only to members, and you help support the show at a whopping 18.3 cents an episode. That's all I'm going to say about that today, because I've got a kind of a special announcement today for you as we lead the show off. There won't be a call with this, but this is we've gotten out of the housekeeping into the main body of the show. So if you're a skipper of the housekeeping, you've skipped far enough. It's time to start listening, because this is a cool thing. About 4-ish years ago, I met a gentleman named Patrick Rohrman of MT Knives. And he approached me, as this was right after I picked up KnifeKits.com as a sponsor and started talking about how cool it was. I thought you could get mammoth tusks there. And he made me a mammoth tusk knife with laminate steel. And it's a beautiful knife that I was, you know, just overjoyed to have and own. And it's actually kind of been a little bit infamous, you know, Jack and his mammoth tusk knife now. And since then, I've had Patrick make other knives for me. I've made him basically my personal knife maker, and if I want something, I go to him for it. And the most recent knife he made me is a Wycliffe blade with a snake wood handle, and I thought that was awesome. And in this time, we have been talking about how do we get Patrick from a place where he is a part-time knife maker and a full-time lineman, and when I say lineman, not for football teams, but working on electrical lines. So when you get a storm in your area and the power's out and people come from all over the country, often it's Patrick that does that. He's got like 7 kids, I think. If I'm wrong, Patrick, if it's 8, don't be mad at me. I just don't remember the number. But he's got a large family, and he's a very loving father, but he spends a lot of time gone. And he's an incredible knife maker. I mean, one of the best I've ever seen. I mean, I could probably get any knife maker out there to do work for me. I probably could get him to do it without paying him. I don't do that with Patrick. I pay him for his work, but I probably could, just because of the exposure that I could get him. And I've chosen Patrick because he's a great person and a great friend. And about almost a year ago now, we first started kicking around, how can we come up with a way to get Patrick into a position where he can make knives full time? Because right now he has gotten into a position where, like, some of the knives he has, you know, contracted to build for people will take a year to deliver, but he doesn't really have a year of work. He has a year of part-time work ahead of him, which is, you know, very sporadic when he gets time to work between being a father and a husband and you know, working a job with a lot of overtime, you can imagine. So we started looking at things like, you know, we thought maybe do a Kickstarter or something like that, and that's just a third party that takes a chunk of what you got, and, you know, what does a person really get other than some product or something out of a Kickstarter? We came up with a program called the Stakeholders Program, and there's only going to be 100 stakeholders, and you're going to be, if you become one, you'll have a number. I'm number one. That was my compensation. The only thing I've taken in return for doing this is position number one. And when you become a stakeholder, you'll get a knife, and that knife will be numbered. And my knife is numbered. I posted a picture of this knife on Facebook last week. 01LE001. And 01LE stands for first limited edition. So 01LE. So the next knife he does that's a limited edition run, he will do 02LE. But I have 001. That means the next position available would be 002 all the way up to 100. That knife is not just a knife, and it's a beautiful knife, 01 tool steel, really gorgeous camo micarta handle, custom pins. This is a neck knife, and it is just a gorgeous knife. But to be honest, if Patrick was building this knife, he would probably sell it for less than it's going to sell for if it was just a knife, even if it was a limited edition run. And the reason is because this knife has something much more attached to it that gives anyone that will help Patrick get started with this and go from part-time to full-time, a stake in MT Knives forever. A true profit-sharing stake in MT Knives. In the future, Patrick will do both, actually three different types of knives. Custom-run limited editions, numbered from 1 to 100. That's really where the stakeholder decision comes in. Custom knives. Somebody comes in and says, I want this, this, and this. He'll build a knife like he always has. And maybe some production run knives that are just more of an entry-level product. That way that there's a product for all of the market to partake in. But every year he'll do at least one or two and maybe some years three or four limited edition runs of 100 knives that are a very specific frame, handle material, pins, size, shape, the whole thing. And that edition will never be repeated. It'll be done once and over. As a stakeholder, you'll look at that knife and decide what you want to do with your knife. Because if you're number 3 or 50 or 62 or like me, number 1, that number of that run is yours. It's yours not just for free, obviously, but it's your knife. You actually have your stake positions in every one of those knives ever made. So let's say you're knife number 10. And the second that you buy the first one, and it's like almost like a stock certificate thing at the knife itself, and it's registered to you so nobody can counterfeit or claim your position. And knife number 10 comes out in the second, so 02LE010, it comes out. And you go, you know what, I think that's a great knife, but I don't have the money right now, I don't want to buy it. I want somebody else to be able to buy that knife. So you, if you do buy it, will pay wholesale. If anybody else buys it, they pay retail. And if you choose to sell it, you don't have to touch it. MT Knives will sell it on your behalf, and you get the difference as profit. So between the wholesale and the retail price, whatever the profit is, you get it 100%. Let's say you decide one day you're filling out your will. You can will the position to your heirs. Let's say one day you decide, look, this is a great thing. I enjoy it, but I could use some money, and I need to liquidate my position. You tell MT Knives, they'll say, we have one of our stakeholders willing to sell their knife and their share in the company, and they'll auction it off for you. I want you to think about if any major knife manufacturer had done something like this, you know, when they started out, what would that kind of a position be worth today in a company with the name recognition, maybe not as large as, but the name recognition of somebody like Buck Knives? It'd be pretty amazing. I'm very proud to say that this program in large is something that I came up with. Certainly Patrick had a lot of influence on it, but I feel incredible that we're able to bring something like this to the market. This is nothing like this has ever been done before. And you can't buy one yet. We're kind of building up to this. We're going to have a launch day. We might even do a launch day party and have Patrick down here and be on live video when we kind of push the button. We're not sure what the launch day is going to be yet, but we're starting a list where you can stay in touch and find out when launch day is going to come. And instead of getting an email saying you can go buy the knife now, that's probably not going to be good enough. You get on the list and you'll know, you know, 8 a.m. Saturday, the whatever, you know, that there's going to go live. And the site will go live. And it's first come, first serve. And you want a low number because in the auction thing, like let's say you say I want to sell my knife. Well, if let's say you're number six and positions zero or one through five decide they're buying theirs, then yours is the first one to go up for sale. So the lower your number, the quicker your knife gets auctioned off for a profit. This is going to be awesome. And it's something that those of you that have the funds and the capability to be part of something like this really want to consider. I don't know that a final price has been set, but you're probably looking somewhere between $500 and $600. But again, it's not buying a knife for $500 or $600 or $550 or whatever Patrick decides is his final price. It's investing in the company and receiving a wonderful knife instead of a piece of paper and then having the ability to earn a profit in the future or lock in and purchase those knives. And, of course, you can sell them on the secondary market. You can give them as gifts. It'll be something that, you know, there's only 100 of us, period, ever. It's kind of an elite group, and it's kind of an interesting thing. And you guys know me. If I didn't have complete confidence in Patrick and his ability, his workmanship, his product, I wouldn't be doing this. This is going to be something that if you can be part of, you're going to want to be part of. If you want to know more, I'll have a link in today's show notes. You can go to mtknives.net, and you'll see a limited edition custom knives for sale link at the top. You can click on that, or I'll put a direct link in today's show notes. And I invite you to make sure you get on this distribution list if there's any way at all you think you can participate in this, because I'm going to go out on a limb and tell you that I think that there's no way that the day we launch this program that it lasts more than 2 hours before the positions sell out. And it's going to be awesome. And there's a video of me talking about the knife and explaining the program in greater detail, all types of details on the page. Again, mtknives.net. Let's go ahead now and take that first call.
Hey, Jack. It's Alex in South Carolina. I've been listening since the Jetta days, and thanks for a great show. My question is for Stephen Harris. I have a bunch of Stable Brand fuel stabilizer that's at least 2 years old. It's been stored in a cool, dark location. Is it safe to use that stuff when it's so old, even though the bottle says it's not? I just don't know if it breaks down on its own. Anyways, thanks and have a great day. Bye.
I thought it'd be fun to lead off today with a question for Mr. Harris. Hey, Stephen, what do you say about the old Stabil?
Hello there, Alex in South Carolina. Sounds like Casey Kasem has come back to life here. This was supposed to be my shortest panel question ever. I'm just going to come out and say, yes, you can, Alex. However, I thought I better research a bit and make double sure. And sure enough, right on the Stable website, you'll find a frequently asked questions list. And right on there, you will find question, what is the shelf life of Stable, registered trademark, fuel stabilizer? Answer, the shelf life of Stable, registered trademark, brand fuel is 2 years after the bottle has been opened, provided it has been tightly capped and stored in a cool, dry place. If the product has not yet been opened, you should use the color of the fluid as an indicator. If the product is still bright red, it's fine to use. If the product has turned to a very dark red or brown color, we recommend purchasing a new bottle. It will not harm anything if you use an old bottle of Stable brand. It just might not be as effective. Guys, isn't that clear as mud? If it's bright red, it's fine. If it's dark red, it might not be. If it's brown, get another bottle. Come on. Wow, the people that make a fuel stabilizer to keep your fuel stable actually made it such that it breaks down over a period of time and it's no good. That's really smart, guys. Now, PRI-G and PRI-D are my favorite Stephen Harris approved fuel stabilizers that I have used on a very regular basis over about the past 10 years. And I checked with one of the head chemists just not but 30 minutes ago over at PRI, and PRI-G and PRI-D have no expiration date on them if you have not opened the bottles. They do not degrade in the bottle. There is no color to check or anything else. If you haven't opened it up, it's good. Oh, the chemist, his name at PRI is Curtis. If you have a question on PRI, you can call him directly. Their phone number is on their website. Plus, he'll be at the Self-Reliance Expo in Denver, October 4th and 5th of 2013. These people are available to you. You can find both PRI-G for gasoline and PRI-D for diesel over at www.solar1234.com. Both come in 32-ounce and 16-ounce bottles. If you add it to your fuel once a year, it will keep that fuel good as long as you keep on adding the additive each year. Yes, this has been done and tested by PRI and other people that I know, and they have successfully stored fuel in excess of 10 years. Next year it'll be 11 years, and the year after that it'll be 12 years. So you can continue to use it and know that it'll work when you need it. Now, Curtis said once you open up PRI, like most people, you put some in your lawnmower, then you put some in your motorcycle, and then next year you'll do the same thing and put some in your boat motor, and you keep on opening and pouring and opening and pouring. You keep on doing this. You should use up the bottle of PRI in about 3 years, okay, which won't be a hard thing to do. I imagine you'd actually use it up a lot faster, especially if you're storing gasoline, as you should be. And even then, it does not go bad. It just loses some of its effectiveness. You might have to use twice as much. But if you're like me, you got 90 gallons of gasoline stored in 15-gallon barrels, then you'll need to be using about a third of a bottle a year, which is a little bit goes a long ways. So you'll use up your bottle easily, and you won't have to worry about it. Do keep it stored in a cool, dark place, as always, and sunshine is the enemy of these chemicals. They're what breaks them down. PRI doesn't come in a transparent, clear bottle like Stable does, which is why it's breaking down and has an expiration date on it. As always, this is Stephen Harris for the expert panel. Thank you very much for calling in the question. I love all of them that I get. Please call in more, and you can find all of my previous stuff I have done with Jack and TSP over at www.solar1234.com. Thanks a lot, guys. Talk to you later.
Hey, Jack. This is Clinton in Findlay, Ohio now. I just moved up here. Question for you. I have 3 acres that we just purchased. The soil is pretty well rotten. It's clay, so there's not a lot of humus in the soil. It's pretty barren. When it dries out, man, it cracks real deep. Some of the things I'm thinking I want to do is chickens. That's a pretty no-brainer. Also looking into tiny cows, miniature cows. I'm curious how many cows I can fit on 2 acres, if I can even do that. Also, is there some kind of seed mix I should be looking into getting so that I can, start the soil or start planting and get some grazing, better habitat for cows and other sort of animals, so I don't have to mow the whole lawn. 2 or 3 acres is a lot of mowing. Looking for, to get some return on my investment here and minimize the amount of time I have to spend mowing and maybe get some beef jerky out of it or... I know you guys were saying that goats require more scrub for habitat and for feed. So what can I do on 3 acres? I also want to do a little orchard, but that'll have to wait for a little while until I figure out maybe I need to do some land farming. So appreciate the show. All you do. Thank you. Bye.
I think you'll find that a lot of times when people are picking up, a 3-acre property, a 5-acre property, a 2-acre property, 1-acre property, a lot of times the land is in pretty bad shape. And a lot of times that is because the land was formerly ranched or farmed, and it wasn't done so with any type of holistic management practices or anything like that. And eventually, the owner of the land decided to sell it in piece and part it out. That's a lot of time where you get these pieces that are, you know, that mid-sized piece of land that many of us can afford. I mean, this is a pretty good description of the property that I'm sitting on right now, 3 acres, etc. I don't want to do cattle, but if I were going to do cattle, I would probably go with a miniature animal. Now, a miniature cow is a misnomer to a lot of people because anything like tiny cattle, I mean, most of your miniature cattle on the down low side of the, you know, the lowest end, you're looking at 200 to 250 pound animals. If you look at a German Shepherd, it typically is, you know, an 80 to 100 pound animal, or a beast like mine, it's 140. It's still a fairly significantly sized creature. And, you know, those are the exception. Most of your miniature cattle breeds range in the 350-ish pound range, up to even animals up as large as adult bulls at 900 pounds are still considered miniature breeds. There's a whole spectrum in there. And I'm not a cattle expert, so I can't tell you what breed I would go with, but I would probably look at an animal in the 300 to 400 pound range at the bottom end, as an adult, if you want to get a lot of the great effects of grazing cattle, because it's not just that they poop and they graze, it's that their feet imprint and press stuff into the land. They mash litter in, which I'm talking about what they don't graze, the leftover grass. They mash their own manure in, etc. You've probably also got very compacted, hard soil, just from the way you're describing it. So chickens are a great idea. And mob grazing the chickens and cattle one after the other, and then following that with seed mix, you bet. Here's the thing with seed mix. Instead of me telling you, you know, buy this seed mix or do this or do that, what you need to find out is what are the perennials that will do well for pasture in your area. Mix in some good hardy annuals from time to time, like broom grass or something like that. And right behind the animals, once they've done their thing for you, see behind them. That's the easiest way to improve your pasture. And you don't need to do a huge amount. You just need to do little bits over time and just keep following them and chasing them with it. It'll really do a lot to improve everything about your pasture. And you can throw in some other things that you don't really think of as pasture plants that will help to decompact the soil, put in fast carbon pathways, and will eventually almost be perennial in many climates. A great example of that would be daikon radish. Daikon is an annual, but if allowed to go to seed, will reseed a lot. You can go out and actually harvest some if you want to, right out of the ground. You can leave them rot in the ground, which is where most of them will. The cattle will eat the tops of them when they come back around in the rotation of the grazing, and they'll do a lot to improve the soil by putting a lot of organic matter into the soil fast. Another thing you might consider adding to your soil mix, which becomes quite perennial, even though technically it's an annual, is different varieties of vetch, purple vetch being one of the hardiest. And because what will happen with vetch is as it grows, it'll put out little pods, and those little pods will be full of little pea-looking seeds, and those seeds will fall to the ground, and many times they'll overwinter, and you'll have vetch coming back. There's a lot of places where vetch just grows wild. My place in Arkansas was harsh, harsh environment. I mean, those of us that seen videos of it, it's rough. It was a wooded piece, and we had wild vetch growing there long before I put any seed down. So those are some things. You can seed things like Caius oat and stuff like that. It makes great forage for the cattle, but it doesn't come back. And you got to, if you're going to do something like oat grass or whatever, you have to be ready to seed as soon as it's been grazed down right behind it so that next rotation is coming through. I'm a much bigger fan of perennials. Paul Wheaton would tell you, don't worry about it, graze the cattle, they'll take care of it for you, and your diversity will increase on its own. I am a bigger fan, especially on a small property like 3 acres. You know, you buy a few hundred dollars worth of seed, and you make your own mixes and put it out behind the grazing, and you're good to go. And you're going to get a lot quicker results. Ben Falk has proven that very much so on his property in Vermont. Couple things. It depends on where you live when you should be throwing seed out. You almost can't throw most seed out when it's too cold. The seed will just go dormant and sit there and wait for its time, as long as it's not in a condition where it's too wet and it will rot on you. You can seed when it's too hot. You can bake seed to death, especially when you're not, you know, harrowing it or covering it over. So your hottest parts of your summer, it probably doesn't make any sense to seed at all. And you should put some thought into selecting varieties of your seeds so that you're seeding the proper things in winter and spring and the proper things in fall and leading into winter. If you do that, you'll have a lot better germination rates. But a lot of times you'll think, well, I put that seed down and it didn't work. And I don't know what happened, but that, you know, I've had to have bird's foot trefoil, you know, like I put that out and it just didn't come up and it didn't come up. And I was like, man, it didn't work. And then the next year it was everywhere. So that sometimes happens as well. It's funny. Different things trigger germination for you. So I would definitely seed, on the cattle, as far as your stocking density. You can probably, if you went with full-size cattle, if you made all 3 acres available for rotational grazing, run 3 head. You know, you could do a bull and 2 cows. You could do 2 cows and have them inseminated and get milk. You could just run, I mean, you could do whatever you want there. That's probably about the maximum density you want to work with on a small property. You could do more, but I probably wouldn't. I probably would select sort of a mid-size, smaller beef animal. You look at cattle, again, that are in the 450-pound range or 500-pound range. That's a lot of beef for a single family, and maybe running 3 head is not a bad idea, and you can do milk with that. You can do it just for meat. It's really up to you. I would highly suggest finding people in your climate, you can say where you're from, that are doing this, and going and talking to them and see how they're doing what they're doing. They may not be doing everything the way you want to with, you know, rotational grazing and following like the Alan Savory or Greg Judy protocols and things like that, but they'll know a lot. You have to think about some other things. You have to think about the needs for a bovine vet. So if you're going to get cattle, make sure you check into that. And you're going to have to make sure that these animals have constant access to water, however you're going to do that, whether it's to bring in a bunch of big steel tanks. And on a property your size, you can bring in enough tanks to pretty much, you know, have that covered. How you're going to get water to those tanks. If you have animals in the heat and they're not watered well, you're going to have real problems. So that's kind of my answer to that one. And I wish you the best with your property. But no doubt, bringing stock into it and seeding behind them with pasture mix will improve your property exponentially over the first couple of years. I really recommend you get Ben Falk's book, even if you're in a different climate type. This is a very similar situation to what he built things up on. It's called The Resilient Farm and Homestead, and I'll put a link in it in today's show notes. Let's take another call.
Hey, Jack. This is Dan in North Carolina. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the pros and cons and maybe some considerations of owning a diesel vehicle, specifically a heavy-duty truck, as a either a primary or a secondary vehicle. I've been considering getting a full-size pickup truck, like, you know, crew cab, four-wheel drive, diesel, you know, like you see everywhere. And, you know, it most likely would be a secondary vehicle for me. I'm just wondering about what kind of things I should consider before purchasing one as far as long-term costs and maintenance, things like that. Thanks a lot.
Let me start out with the fact that I love diesel motors. I love big ones. I love little ones. I love powerful ones. I love little quiet, sleek, fast ones with lots of little torque on the bottom and top end like my Jetta. And I love big, deep, bottom end, heavy, pull a house down diesels like my F-350. And I really can't see a day in my life where I won't own at least one diesel. And I start out with that because I'm going to tell you that not everything is good with a diesel. But everything that you can measure performance and longevity-wise is better with a diesel than with a gas motor. If you turbocharge a gas motor, you reduce its life expectancy. If you turbocharge a diesel, not only do you get, in many instances, actually better fuel economy and more power, but you get a longer life motor. Most gas motors, I mean, they're building vehicles today, no matter what anybody says about how things were much better in the 50s. Vehicles today are actually very well built. And, you know, a lot of cars with 100,000 miles on them were pretty much on their last legs, you know, in the 70s. If you had a car with 100,000 miles, I know somebody's going to write in, I had this Chevelle, and I know. You took care of it meticulously, and it went a million miles or whatever. But in general, with people driving with the habits they have and the maintenance habits they have, a lot of cars were kind of like, you know, pretty much worn out. And even today, that 100,000 mile mark is a big deal. You go to trade in a vehicle with 70,000 miles on it, and you go to turn in one that's got 100,000 miles on it, and the difference in the trade-in is enormous, including if the vehicles are the same year, model, options, everything, right? So that 100,000 mile mark is a big deal in the mind of the consumer and in the mind of the market that sells vehicles. where the general attitude about a good diesel motor that's been well maintained at 100,000 miles is what? You've probably heard it. It's just getting broken in. And there's a lot of truth to that. I know a lot of people with the little Jetta diesels, like I have 600,000, 700,000 miles on them. I know trucks that have been driven into the point where the truck literally is just falling apart and the motor is still running. So they have incredible longevity, lots of power, but they do have some things that are not maybe better than gas from a standpoint of owning and having to maintain the vehicle. Just the cost. I mean, the upfront cost is definitely higher. When you buy a used vehicle, which I highly recommend with a diesel, because there is so much life left in them, even when they've got 70, 100, 120,000 miles on them, if they're well maintained, you can get that cost differential way down. But when you buy a new vehicle, it's a huge premium on a diesel. That's not really what I'm talking about. I'm talking about day-to-day maintenance things. Let's just look at changing the oil. My F-350 uses 15 quarts of oil. 15 quarts. That's almost 4 gallons. Think about that. That's almost 4 milk jugs full of oil just to change the oil. An air cleaner for my F-350 is not like your typical $12, $15 air cleaner you can pick up at Walmart. It's like $88 for an air cleaner. It's very important that you maintain, you know, that part of the vehicle as well, and more with a diesel in many ways. You've got the turbocharger sucking all that stuff in and all. I mean, so it's, and if you start, let's say you have a problem with your vehicle, something beyond your ability to fix it, you go down a Discount Auto or Pep Boys or whatever, if that location doesn't have a diesel tech on staff, they'll tell you, I'm sorry, we can't work on it in many instances. You need tires or brakes, that's not a problem. When it comes to engine work, it's a specialized knowledge thing, and you'll find it costs more to have done and less shops available. Day-to-day driving. All of a sudden, every time you're going by a gas station and thinking, I need to fill up, you're looking to see, do they have, you know, is there a diesel pump? You start learning to look for the green pump handles as you're driving around, especially places where you're not going to pull over right now, but you're just trying to put in your mind in the area you live and work in, where are places with diesel? It's not a huge deal, but there will be times when you're like, damn, that place doesn't have diesel. Damn, that place doesn't have diesel. These are all things you have to consider when it comes to, do I want a diesel in my life? The fact that you said this is a secondary vehicle, though, I actually think for many people, that's where the diesel shines. If you want a truck, and you're not going to have that truck be a daily driver, it's going to be a truck that you're going to use when you got to pull something or haul something or when you're going to go out off-roading or whatever, it is very difficult to beat the diesel for that. If you maintain that vehicle, make sure you don't get rust problems with the body and keep it, you know, in good shape, keep your maintenance up on it and things like that, and you're not daily driving it, and you've got a vehicle that you can easily run 300,000 or 400,000 miles, you've got a lifetime vehicle. You really do. In fact, you know, at some point you might want to like say, you know, it hasn't run for a while, I'm going to go fire it up and use it today. Just because on some levels you do need that vehicle rolling once in a while and running once in a while. Another thing to think about is, you know, there's issues with cold weather. A lot of diesels, especially older ones, have a little plug, and, you know, if it's going to be overnight, you know, below freezing, well below freezing, you got to plug them in so that they'll freaking start in the cold. Some of the newer vehicles seem to have some ways around that. I'm not real up on the latest in diesel technology. My preference is older vehicles. I actually think with diesel, that makes a lot of sense. A good vehicle in good condition that's, you know, 5, 10 years old right now. There's a lot of them at great prices. A lot of people are very much put off by the cost of diesel fuel. And let's face it, these are not vehicles that get 40 miles to the gallon. So with cost-conscious consumer going on right now, a lot of these work vehicles that have reached the end of their work cycle. And that doesn't mean they're not good work trucks anymore. It just means the guy's got a construction company. And he's got some kind of a program lease deal arrangement with you know, Ford or Chevy. And when his vehicles are a certain years old, he turns his fleet over. And recently, a lot of businesses to shave have been running those cycles a little bit longer, but you're still looking at 3 to 5 years many times. These vehicles go into the secondary market. They've been beat a little bit, but they can handle it. And they've probably been well-maintained. Because a lot of these companies that do this have agreements as part of their fleet leasing. The vehicle goes there and gets its oil changed and stuff like that. And there's a lot of great deals out there. So that's kind of my viewpoint on it. If you want something tough, strong, that'll last forever, you want a diesel. If you want the most economical vehicle, from a standpoint of initial purchase and maintenance, you don't want a diesel. It's going to cost more, but it's going to cost less over the life of the vehicle, in my view, because you have less need of replacement. But some things can get expensive. I've had to do one time like $2,600 worth of work on my Ford. It was a job I could have done, but the amount of time I would have taken to do it would have been excessive. Before I take the next call, I just want to say, if you do hear anything that sounds like a little bit of peeping in the background today, it's because there's 50 Freedom Ranger chickens in a stock tank sitting on a table in my office. I don't know if you guys can hear that or not, but they are there. I just thought I'd throw that in. Let's go ahead and take another call.
Hey, Jack, this is Paul from Nebraska. Looking for some advice on making some money on the side. I've looked into melting down lead, such as the wheel weights, the fishing weights you can get at local recycling centers, and then maybe casting those into 12-gauge slugs or double-aught buck pellets. I reload and could use it if I wasn't able to sell it. Online, I've seen double-aught buck going for about $5 a pound. Any reason why this might be a bad idea? I thought I could just market it in my local area, maybe on Craigslist, maybe at gun shows. Also, another thought was, what about making buckets, putting rice and beans in there, vacuum pack, you know, vacuum sealing them with oxygen absorbers, selling that in the local area, you know, garage sales, things like that. Any thoughts on that? Thanks again for all you do.
Okay, so let's start out with the idea of the food buckets. That one makes me a little bit more leery than the lead idea, and here's why. You're selling something that people can put in their body. That goes into a whole new world of regulations and things like that. I'm not saying not to do it. I'm saying that, you know, there's nutritional information requirements and stuff like that. It'd be a great idea if you simply took all the original packaging and maybe somehow made all of the stuff that was already there available to the person from a nutritional standpoint. The good news with that one is it's a really easy thing to test market. You can put together a few of them and see how it works out. And if it doesn't work out, well, it's not that big a deal. The lead idea, I actually like a lot better. It's a lot more unique. And I think there's some real opportunities there. One, you can just go on a price advantage, it seems. I mean, you're gonna have to try this. And you're gonna have to see how much buckshot you can cast in an hour. And, you know, you could say, well, I'm making X percentage markup on the lead, but by the time you look at the cost of heating it and the man hours that go into it, you have to determine whether or not you're really making a profit or not. But I like that. Casting bullets might have a better return of investment for you, especially with a little bit of industry knowledge. Here's that little bit of industry knowledge. Lee, as in Lee Reloading, will make you a bullet mold any way you want it done. If you have it designed to spec and send them what you're looking for, they will cut you a mold custom, and it's not real expensive to do so. If I was going to go into bullet casting today as a sideline business to make some money, I would reach out to people in my area that specifically load cast bullets and say, what do you wish you could get your hands on? So, you know, so maybe they want a big sledgehammer flat nose load for a 38 that's bigger than anybody loads, or a 44 bigger than anybody loads, or a lightweight design, or some sort of a, it was something that they want that they can't get elsewhere, a customized hard lead hunting load or something like that. And I would see about maybe coming out with four or five different slugs that you can't get anywhere else. And shotgun slugs, there is an interesting shotgun slug that you can also get a mold for from Lee. Instead of a Foster style slug, this is a slug that's very reloadable. It's called, I think it's called a keyhole slug. And it, when you load your shotgun shell, it goes, the wadding, that normally is the wadding cup that normally holds the shot, it fits right in there like a sabot. And these, apparently, I've never fired one for sure, but according to Richard Lee, and it is his company and his product, and people always say their product's good, but Richard's been pretty, everything I've ever checked, the man said, has ever always checked out. I use a lot of reloading equipment from Lee. That if you fire that in a rifled shotgun barrel, then it acts just like a sabot. That wadding twists down the barrel and flies free at the end. So those are some things I would check into. And I'm a little bit more excited about the opportunity there for you with lead, and I think if you talk to enough tire shops, you may be able to get the lead for even less than buying it like at a scrapyard or something like that and drive your costs down even further. And that might lead you to some things like talking to their staff and maybe to some customers. It's one thing to make a product, you got to find customers for it. So I'd go to shooting ranges, I'd look for anybody at that range shooting cast lead bullets and say, hey, what are you doing? Where do you get them? How much you pay for them? I'm thinking about doing this for a living. Would you be interested in buying some for me? Is there any, you know, that type? Maybe a little slower, I'm trying to talk fast because we're on the air, right? A little slower, a little lower key than that. But most of the time I found when you're at a gun range and you start asking somebody questions about what they're doing, they're very open. You know, some people are jerks or some people are maybe having a bad day, but I'd say 90% of the time, hey, what's your name? I'm Jack. I got this. You got that. What do you got? The AK there? What are you shooting? And where'd you get it? And how's it working for you? I mean, every time I've ever started a conversation at a gun range, it's almost always inevitably ended up with I'm shooting their gun and they're shooting one of mine. So it's a very easy environment to talk to people that are your target market. So that's the approach I'd take with it. Great call. I'm glad you're looking for a way to kind of capitalize on things. I'm not poo-pooing the bucket idea. I just feel better for some reason about the lead casting idea. And you can start with off-the-shelf stuff and teach yourself how to do it and try to make a little bit of money. But I'd be thinking long-term into something along the lines of some sort of a custom cut bullet. Or something like that. There's probably a lot of opportunity out there. I like that. And again, I know Lee will make any mold you ask them to make as long as it actually will work. If it won't work, they're pretty sure they'll tell you. Let's go ahead and take another call.
Hey, Jack. It's Matt from Michigan. Root Strike in the forums. Hey, I'm listening to episode 1178, Frank Sharp Jr., where he's talking about backup handgun parts. And I was wondering with regard to recoil springs, if you have extra handguns, is it better to store them, you know, disassembled with the recoil spring out and not under tension? And then also the same question for magazine springs. Is it better to leave them maybe half full versus fully full and compressed springs? So two questions. Yeah, either for you or Frank. Recoil springs and magazine springs, should you leave them at rest when you're not using it for your carry weapon? Thanks again for all you do, and love the show. Bye.
You know, I've had my hands on so many different semi-auto handguns, older military specification guns, stuff that's been around for 50 years, 80 years, and I've never seen a gun with weak springs because it wasn't stored disassembled, and I just don't see the need to do that. If you want to, that's fine. I would actually make a better case for this way. If you have extra handguns, they're going to be in long-term storage, and you don't want to worry about rust as much, disassembling them and oiling them up and all, and, you know, keeping them packed up maybe in bags or something. You know, maybe I could make a better case for that with it being less likely to develop rust, making sure you've got oil everywhere it needs to be, that the weapon's fully cleaned. If it's an older gun that may have fired some surplus ammo, there's no residual powder in there. They could have some corrosive compounds or something like that. I can't make a case for disassembling a handgun or any gun for that matter so that the springs won't be put into tension. In fact, unless you're storing it with the slide back, there's not a lot of tension on really anything anyway. So I just wouldn't even worry about the handguns. If I was disassembling them for storage, it would be for some other reason other than worried about the springs. Now, if they were specifically, I have this gun, it's a full gun, I can use it for anything I want, but it also represents spare parts, it might be a little faster to go get a spare part, but it would also be more faster to just go get a spare gun. So I really don't see the point there. Maybe if you were trying to store some guns in ways that they were fully concealed, there might be some advantages. Leave it at that. Now, magazine springs. If you had asked me this question 4 years ago, I would have definitively said that it makes a lot of sense to rotate your mags and, you know, don't leave them compressed for long lengths of time and what have you. And with some older magazines, I've seen weak magazine springs. Specifically stuff like Remington 760 3006 was my go-to deer rifle, and those old five-round magazines for those, I have some that I ended up throwing away. With older steel and stuff like that. So maybe some old Mil-Serp stuff might be that way. I don't know. But when I came out and said this, I had people from Magpul get into my butt basically and say, hey, we've tested this. And at least with our magazines, we don't have any memory problems at all. You know, load up a magazine, leave it sit for years. since then, I've had mags that I've loaded up and thrown in ammo cans and let sit for a year or two or more. I went to the range one day, pulled one of those mags out, and this is Magpul and some other well-made magazines, and thrown them into a weapon and had them function as flawlessly as anything else. So I don't know that it's a huge concern, but I also think if you have a lot of magazines, it doesn't really do a tremendous advantage to have them all loaded all the time. So rotating them probably won't hurt anything, but I think that our belief that it's necessary or how much good it does us is largely inaccurate and based on older technology and older springs. Because I haven't been able to get any magazine, and I've tried it now. I've taken mags for my 1911. I've taken mags for, hell, the mags for my High Point 995 carbine. I've taken SIG mags that go in my Sub 2K, my Kel-Tec Sub 2K, loaded them up and left them for a year. And, you know, you chamber that first round, they fire perfectly, or if you thumb the rounds out, they come flying out. I haven't actually been able to get any modern spring-fed magazine to develop memory or become weak. I'm not saying it's never happened again. The 760 that I had as a deer rifle, I know I had magazines go bad in that thing. I remember it. I remember giving up on trying to fix one and throwing it away. So I'm not saying it can happen. I'm saying with most modern mags, I just don't think it's the issue we think it is anymore. Great question. Let's take another call.
Hey, Jack. This is Greg down here in Texas. I've got a quick question. I'd like to plant some dwarf fruit trees on my place, and the best place that it seems to be as far as solar aspect and that sort of thing is over my drain field. So my question is, should I consider doing that or find a better place for the plants that won't cause me maintenance headaches later on my drain field? Or you know, with a dwarf rootstock, is that ever even actually going to cause a problem? So that's my question. Thanks for what you do through the show. Take care. Bye-bye.
This is the vampire question, because it never dies, or the zombie question. It just keeps coming back from the dead over and over again. What can I do with my leach field? I would never plant aggressive rooted perennials in a leach field. Even dwarfing rootstocks I would be very leery of, because what's going to happen is you've got a situation where there's a lot of moisture and nutrient down in there. And even a tree that generally has a pretty mild root system is going to know it's there, intrinsic intelligence kind of thing. And because it's relatively easy to penetrate, it's going to get in there, and it's going to start causing shit to clog up. It's going to happen, and it doesn't make a lot of sense. Bushes and shrubs that are shallow-rooted would be about as big as I would go. And I want to talk about, again, gardening over a leach field. Generally, it's considered a health risk and a bad idea and things like that. I've owned three houses now with leach fields and septic systems. I have never once seen a septic system overflow in the leach field specifically. I've seen tanks back up. I have never seen a leach field, you know, overflow. Not once in my life. I think that the, you know, because people say it's a risk of contamination if any type of vegetable were to touch the ground, and I just think that we live in a world of safety police nonsense at this point. The official answer, don't plant anything that can touch the ground over your leach field because of risk of contamination. My personal opinion is, if your leach field doesn't belch out and overflow, it's pointless, meaningless, and there is no risk, in my personal opinion. I'm not saying that I'm right, I'm saying that's what I believe. And I know a lot of people who have done it, and I don't know anybody who's died from it or got E. coli poisoning from it or anything like that. So that's my thoughts there. But no, I wouldn't plant trees even really close to the edge of a leach field, because if you look at everything that can go wrong with a septic system and what's going to cost you the most, it's that leach field. It's very expensive when you have problems there, and that's a problem you want to avoid in advance. Let's take another call.
Good morning, Jack. This is Daryl in Pennsylvania again. Question for you. I've heard several routes by which to get spouses involved. How would we go about encouraging an older generation? For instance, my mom, I'd like to get her into survivalism, preparedness, those types of things. But she seems to be a bit more stubborn. She likes the can. But she likes to freeze as well, and I've kind of asked her a few times, what if the power goes out, then the freezer is going to thaw. What type of steps can we take to get an older generation involved? Thanks. I look forward to hearing from you. Thank you much.
Well, it's an interesting question because you say the older generation, and what does that really mean? I know what you mean. You're probably about my age. Older generation's probably in their 60s. But if you're 20, the older generation's in their 40s. And if you're 15, the older generation's in their 20s. Right? So the reason I point that out is so that you'll understand something. It's something that Dave Ramsey calls powdered butt syndrome. Now, Dave focuses on money and debt and investing, and that's it. So he comes at this just from a monetary advice thing. But you get people call his show all the time. I don't listen to it much anymore, but back when I was still driving to work and back all the time, it was one of the things I listened to, you know. And I remember a lot of times people calling in and going, I've been doing this, and we've got our life squared away, and thank you so much, and we're debt-free now. But my mom, my dad, et cetera, is really in a lot of trouble or getting close to retirement, and they won't listen to me about this. And they would say it's because they have what's called powdered butt syndrome. And that's because at some time in your life, they powdered your butt. And once you've powdered somebody's butt, you're probably not really likely to listen to them when it comes to advice about money. And with prepping, it's probably even more the case. So the harder you push, the more of the powdered butt syndrome you will feel. Now, that doesn't mean we can't do this. There's a lot of ways we can do this. One thing I've noticed about people in the age bracket you're talking about is they have all lived through some things that are a lot harder than what we're living through today. And generally, when you ask them about it, they're happy to tell you about it. I'm kind of concerned, though, for this group of people coming into their retirement years right now, the baby boomers. And I'm going to tell you why. They didn't have the hardship. They don't know what it was. They remember maybe were told about it by the World War II generation that raised them. But they didn't have it. Now, if you can put them in touch with any of it, maybe the fear of the Cold War, what was it like? Do you remember the day that Kennedy laid the blockade on Cuba and the Cuban Missile Crisis? And if you can get them talking about that, maybe it'll lead to some things. Not pushing, but pulling. What do you think? What did you guys do? You know, what would have happened if, right? But they really, I mean, that's that generation, that's about it. They had the recession of the 70s, and it was never as bad as everybody said it was going to be, so, man, this is it. And then, you know, they went through this recent 2008 debacle, and, like, they were all afraid they were going to retire, and things have pretty much held together, and they've not been through it. If you asked my grandparents about it, they could tell you about it. They could tell you about the Great Depression. They could tell you about World War II. And sadly, that generation is rapidly leaving us. I think ahead to a day when we'll hear what we heard not very long ago. Not very long ago, we heard the last veteran of World War I died. Guys, we're not that far away. We're not that far away from hearing that about the last World War II veteran. I mean, right now, if you were 18 in 1945 at the tail end of the war, you're around 68 years old. So there's a lot of people left that went through World War II. But let's face it, at 68, you're getting into that twilight of your life. Some people live to be 108, but not many of us do. 78 is a pretty, you know, median average. I think the CDC says it's 72 or 74 is the median average life expectancy now. We're getting to where we're going to lose that generation. And the reason I bring that up is so we can understand what we're losing and the knowledge that generation had about hard times. And that's the last real hard times generation from America. And we may be about to see a new hard times generation, and I don't know if we're ready. But one way you might be able to reach the 60-something is through the 80-something. Because they don't have powdered butt syndrome there. That's something that might be possible. There's some other things I can think of, though. So you said that she likes to can. What if you talk to her about doing some canning for you? Maybe you even pay her for it and bring her the food and say, I'm going to bring you a bunch of stuff to can, and then you can it, and I'll pay for all the food, and maybe I'll pay you for doing it. Or if she won't take money, just let her do it, but then leave some of it behind for her. That might be another great thing. Go to a farmer's market. Load up on some stuff. ask her to teach you how to do it. If you can get your wife involved, ask her to teach your wife how to do it. Ask her to teach your kids how to do it. They're going to need to know. Harness what is already there. Don't push. Don't push. It's very hard for a child, even an adult child, and even an accomplished adult child, to tell their parents much of anything about anything unless that parent is decided that they're ready to hear it. My father, come home from the Army, 3 years working on the biggest diesel equipment in the world, out working on one of his tractors for him. Ah, you don't know what you're doing. You know, you just don't, you don't push. You know, you're thinking, I could tear this thing apart in my sleep now, Dad, but, you know, if that's what you think and you want to tell me how I should be doing it, I'll listen, because I care about the relationship. And that's just the dynamic many times that exists with parents. So I want you to think about it this way. If you didn't buy into this, if you have kids, and let's say you move forward in time a little bit so those kids are like in their teens, and your 12-year-old or 13-year-old is coming to you and go, Daddy, look, man, I mean, I'm worried about our future and things like that. Sort of explaining all the stuff that you know to you. How resistant would you be? And you'll think, well, I'm not 15 or 14, and I know what's going on, and I'm awake, and we've done this stuff, and it works. And my it doesn't matter. You're always your mom's little boy or your daddy's little girl. It's not going to change. So it's much easier to talk to them about the past and try to put them in touch with times where they felt as though things were at risk and what they did, and let them think they're teaching you, okay? A little bit manipulative, not really, because they are, than it is to try to teach them. And maybe at some point they'll be ready and they'll ask. I think the most important thing we could be doing right now, though, if you want to get people of, you know, the older generation, as you call it, involved, is get people of the truly older generation, the 70-somethings, the 80-somethings that are still with us, that are still sharp, that remember World War II, that remember rationing, that remember what it was really like when there wasn't 100 cable channels to tell you everything that was going on in the world, and even the people that never went to Europe or the Pacific Theater, that had family or friends or brothers or sisters and would have to wait for weekly updates of names of the injured and the dead. That sometimes didn't come for multiple weeks and never really knowing and waiting for one letter. That generation is so valuable, not because of the marketing of being the greatest generation, but because of what they saw and what they know. And folks, we're losing it. We're losing it. And when it's gone, we're going to have to be completely on our own. It might even be worth some sort of an initiative, some sort of a program to get that information available for people. People ask me all the time, what would you do for a podcast or a show? How about a podcast that just talks about the history of America and revolves around interviewing people who are all in their 80s and asking them about 60 years ago and back? I'd listen. That would get through to me if I was 65. With that, let's take another call. All right, actually, I had this queued up. I've got a question for the expert council, and the reason I'm not playing the call is it didn't come in as a call. Remember, if you want to make a call for the expert council, we have them listed on every Friday show. You'll see a list at the bottom of all the members and their websites so you can see what they do and what they're all about and pick out the right person for you. And it's best you call in, you call the Think Line, you leave your message, and then email me right away and say, I just called in a question for council member whoever from number XYZ, whatever your number is, because that helps me find your call and be more likely to get it ahead. The reason I'm doing this as a written-in version for the expert council is this was not for the expert council. This was for me. But when I read it, I decided that I had somebody on the council that would be better suited to answer this question. Here's the question from Patrick. Jack, I'm trying to complete an AR build, and I'm at a stopping point. The barrel I bought didn't have or come with a sight or gas tube block. I've seen gas tube blocks sold by themselves, and I've seen integrated gas tube block sights. My question is, how do I make sure the hole in the barrel aligns properly with the gas tube block? It seems like it would be really easy to misalign the holes as I attach the gas tube block to the barrel. Do you have recommendations on properly aligning and installing the gas tube block to the barrel? Also, do you have any recommendations on the gas tube block itself? I have seen a big old swing in price for that single part anywhere from $25 to over $100, depending on make and whether the site is integrated with the block. Thank you, Patrick. And it probably will come to nobody's shock that I have decided to kick this one to Frank Sharp Jr., a Fortress Defense consultant. So, hey, Frank, what are your thoughts on this?
Hi, Jack. This is Frank from Fortress Defense responding to Patrick's question regarding the installation of a gas block on an AR-15. His concern is that the hole in the barrel will not line up with the gas tube unless it's installed exactly correctly. The gas block should butt up against the front bracket for the handguard, and that should space it forward and back pretty close. I believe they oversized those holes for that event. But truthfully, I have actually never installed one of those blocks. I've tightened a number of them on students' guns. That's kind of led me to the conclusion that they don't hold up really well under heat and heavy use. I'm a big fan of the old style front sight towers where they're actually pinned in place. Those I've never seen rattle apart, but the aftermarket gas blocks I have. I don't have a specific brand I would recommend, but I would want it to have some sort of rail or a way to mount an iron sight on it. Our rifles become very useless quickly without having backup iron sights on them. I did a quick cursory YouTube search, and there's probably about 20 or 30 videos on there of how to install those blocks. That might be a great place to start to get your questions answered. For the listeners, Fortress will be in Highview, West Virginia on September 14th and 15th for a Level 1 handgun course. We still have some space in there if you'd like to get a hold of us. Our email is info@fortressdefense.com. Our phone number is 708-522-8060. That's info@fortressdefense.com. Our phone number again is 708-522-8060. And may you all have victory.
Jack, I have a question for you about random drug tests. My daughter is going into her junior year of high school, wants to play sports. And this year, the school is requesting that we submit to her to random drug tests. My daughter's never been in trouble before. She's never had any sort of issues with drugs or alcohol. I kind of feel like this is a violation of her rights. My wife thinks she understands my point, but she thinks we should just do it because she has nothing left. She has nothing to hide anyway. I'm on the other side of that. I feel like we should say, no, you have no right to do that. Show me proof. Show me reasonable cause. And I may allow you to do that. Wanted to get your thoughts on it. Thanks, Jack, for everything you do. Bye-bye.
I have a question for you. Why are you and your wife the one discussing what to do here? I don't want to sound, you know, harsh or anything. But as parents, and as you're getting into high school level stuff, we're to be handing more and more things off to our children, are we not? Your daughter is the one now that has to decide, do I want to do this and play sports, or do I not want to do this and play sports? Because here's how it works. If your wife makes this decision, she's saying it is more important that she play sports than we speak up for our rights. If you do this, then you are saying, based on your current places you're entrenched at, it is more important that we speak up for our rights than she play sports. The reality is, she's going to have to make decisions like this for herself in the future. I'm going to give you my thoughts on the whole thing in a minute, but I just want to start out with that. And I'm not saying you definitely should do this. I'm saying maybe you should consider this and let her make a decision, because she might be like, you know what, I don't care. I want to play sports more than I want to fight this. And honestly, at an issue at this level, if that's what she wants, that's what she wants. Now, let me talk about whether or not this violates a right. The first question we have to ask is, do you have a right to play sports in school? Is that a right or is that a privilege? I would say it's definitely a privilege. If it wasn't, everybody would play and nobody would get cut. Okay? So just by that alone, we know you don't have a right to play sports. Okay? So this is an extracurricular activity. If they were going to do random drug testing to go to school at all, I would say no. And I would fight that tooth and nail, because as long as you're taxing everybody to fund public schools and saying it so everybody can go, I would say maybe you don't have a right to an education, but you have a right as a United States citizen who's sharing a burden of the tax to participate in a public education system because of how it's set up. Do you have a fundamental right for somebody to provide you an education? No. Do you have a right to it in the current system? Yes. So if it was, we're doing random drug testing on all students, I would rally parents, I would get everybody together, and I would fight that, and I would clean out the school board if I had to. That's not what this is. This is, do you want to participate in an extracurricular activity that you have to try out to achieve? So, you want to do that? Part of the deal is we do random drug testing. We don't want to do random drug testing. Let's look at this another way then. What if the deal was, well, it's softball. Now, let's say, I don't know what she's trying out for, but let's say it was softball. And let's say they said, you know what, part of the softball team is that we run with a bat held up over our heads. It's one of the drills that we do. We run the bases 5 times before each practice, holding the bat up like a soldier does with a rifle, and then we do it at the end, and that's part of our conditioning. And you said, well, I don't see the point of that. That doesn't seem to really relate to softball to me. You don't run around with bats over your heads in softball, so I don't want to do that. And they said, well, then you don't get on the team. I mean, we have to look, is there any reasonable things that a coach or an administration can require of a person to be in these extracurricular activities? And I'd say the answer is yes. So it's at least plausible then that it's a reasonable request on some level. The next thing is, does the school face any consequences if an athlete is using drugs? And I think the answer is definitively yes, in more than one way. Unlike a kid that goes to school, is in school, and goes home, athletes are at the school and participate in activities at times when there's not full supervision. There's only a small coaching staff. They get on buses and go to other schools. Sometimes they go to camps overnight. It's actually a much bigger problem if you have athletes using illegal drugs. If the school is a true contender in the state and gets certain recognition for it, there's also a risk of sanctioning if it turns out they have students on performance-enhancing drugs. So this is what I tell you. If you said to me, well, I want to get a job working for Firestone, and they have random drug testing, and I don't think it complies with my rights, I'd say don't work at Firestone. And if you say that's the only place that will hire me in the tire business, I'd say then get in a different business. Because it's their business, and they have a right to determine how they screen their employees. I feel a school has a right to screen athletes that way. And if you don't like it, then you need to find a school district and live in it that doesn't do that, or go to a private school that doesn't do that, if that exists. Do I think we should be doing it? Not really. Do I find it invasive on rights? Yes. Do I find it legally acceptable under the current system? Absolutely. Do I see justifications for it? Yes. Do I understand why some students object? Yes. But in the end, I would sit down with my daughter and say, honey, I want to explain how all this works, and I want you to know that I feel this is an invasion of your rights. Your wife should say, I feel that this is like a thing. You both should be heard. And understand that your daughter is not a thing. She's a human being with her own opinions. It's going to form them growing up. And it's okay for her to hear two sides of the story, even from both parents who are in conflict with each other, and then make her own decision. I would say that the consequences of her saying yes are she pees in a cup and she plays sports. She's probably not on drugs, or we wouldn't even be having this conversation. Okay? So the consequences are nothing other than she might feel that I should have had to do that, but I chose to. And I don't think that it affects her life in any way long term. I don't think that's going to make her more likely to be okay with the NSA wiretapping her phone. I don't think they're on the same level. So I think the consequences of her doing it are low. Low enough that she can be trusted with the decision. I think the consequences of her not doing it, I'm going to focus more on academics than sports, and I'm not going to play organized sports in school. I don't think that's that big of a tragedy either. What I'm saying is it's a decision where the consequences on both sides of it are pretty benign. And those are the types of decisions that as good parents we should be handing off to our children, fully informed, but letting them make the decision. This really isn't your choice, and it really isn't your wife's choice. At least it doesn't have to be. There's no need for it to be. It's not fair for me to tell you it's not your decision. It is your daughter, and I understand. And I'm sorry for putting it that way. I don't mean it that way. I would be pretty pissed if somebody told me that about my son when he was 14 or 15 years old. It's not your decision. No, but what I would say more accurately is it doesn't have to be. You can choose, in this case, to let it be her decision, and I think you'll be proud of whatever decision she makes when she tells you why she's made it. And I think that'll be really cool. And I think that at this age, this is where we start looking for those decisions. We start looking for those decisions that are not going to severely scar a child and letting them make them for themselves. That's part of turning our young people into strong adults. Let's take another call.
Jack, hey, it's Bruno from London, England, with a question about drinking water. I've got a bunch of those 5-gallon Walmart blue jugs of water that have been sitting in the storage locker for about a year now. And I know they're still safe to drink, but I was just wondering if there's anything I could do to get rid of that stale taste. And I'm just wondering where that stale taste even comes from. Anyway, man, thanks. Thanks for your show. Just a quick note for your other overseas listeners. Many of us don't have the phones with the letters on it. So it is very useful when you repeat the phone number with the actual digits. Anyway, man, keep up the great work.
Well, thanks for calling. I love when I hear from people from the international market. Let me give you kind of my quick answer to what do you do about it. Water your garden with it, dump it down the drain, do something else with it, and replace it. And make a policy of water stored that way, of rotating it, let's say every 6 months. Okay? And if you end up having to use it and it hasn't been rotated, and it's right toward the end of the rotation, it tastes a little stale. What you can do to put a little bit of life in it might be a trip through the pot with a little bit of boiling or something like that. But it's probably going to have kind of a stale taste, and it's probably got more of a plastic taste. So what is that taste? And it is from being in contact with plastic. And if it was sitting in a stainless steel drum, it would have somewhat of a metallic taste from being in contact with metal. And it's just the way that it is. That doesn't mean that there's harmful residues in there. It's food-grade plastic. It's not going to harm you. It's probably not what I would want to drink every day of my life, but for emergency situations, it's fine. And I wouldn't worry about it too much. But there's nothing you can do to prevent it from happening. Something you could do that might perk it up a bit for you, you're still going to have some taste in it, though, would be to you know, if you ran an aquarium pump airstone through it a bit and lifted it a bit, that'll lift water a bit. It is a little more refreshing after that's been done for a while, but that's an energy demand, and I don't know that it's worth it. I mean, it's kind of just, it is the way that it is what I'm getting at. I do want to say something about these blue water tank jugs. Like, they almost look like a water, like a gasoline can that you can get from, like, Walmart, and I don't know if you have Walmart in the UK, but, you know, department stores. I hate them. And I'll tell you why I hate them. Because I've seen them break when they shouldn't. I think sitting in your storage locker or whatever, they're not going to break and they're probably fine maybe, I don't know. But I don't like things that fail, as a matter of course. So here's why I hate them. Many years ago, I liked them, and I used to do a lot of shore fishing. It's something I should probably take up doing again because it's only a 5-hour drive down to Freeport. Maybe I should set up a simple let's go fishing on the beach trip. I'm going to just say that right now. If you'd be interested in sometime this fall, maybe meeting me and some other TSP people like on Bryan Beach down at the state park down there and just doing some shore fishing and maybe one night camping out on the beach, send me an email, shorefishingwithjack, in the subject line of jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com. If there's an interest, maybe we'll do that. Maybe we'll do something on one of the piers out on Corpus Christi. That would be low cost and easy for people to do. And I've had some great sand trout fishing down in the Corpus Christi area on one of the piers down there, if I can figure out where that was. And that was like between One year that was between Thanksgiving and Christmas that I was there, and it was amazing. Maybe we can put something together, just if you're interested as a side, right? But here's the deal, right? So I used to do that a lot. And there's not a lot of fresh water in the ocean. So take water with you. I take lots of water bottles and stuff. And one day I was like, why don't I take one of these big blue things I have that I got at Walmart, fill it with water, and I'll have 5 gallons of water. I can wash my hands, wash my feet, you know, cook with it. It'll be great. So I put it in there. And because of this, I took less bottles of water in my cooler. I got down to the beach, and this was, I used to leave in the dark, and I'd get down there at first sun, crack of sunlight and fish for, you know, sometimes I'd go down there, 5 hour drive down, fish for about 5 hours, drive home that evening. And that's what this trip was going to be, thankfully. Get down there, pull up on the beach, and get in the back of the truck, start pulling out my gear, and I pick that freaking heavy 5 gallon jug, it's 40 pounds of water, man, 43, 44 pounds of water, 5 gallons. And I went to pick it up, and you know, you go to lift something heavy and with your arm extended over the truck so you're all ready to pick it up, and it's like, hey, this doesn't weigh anything at all. It's empty. So I looked at the bottom of it, and just from the vibrations of driving down the road, the seam ruptured and all the water ran out of it. So I thought, Jack, you can't be a dick like this. It's just the product that failed. This happens. It was a bad one. Maybe you threw it in there and didn't realize how hard you dropped it. Maybe it was sitting on something, but surely, like, these things aren't so weak that they just rupture when you drive down a highway for 5 hours sitting in the back of a pickup truck. So I got another one. And about 2 months later, I decided to do one of my little shore fishing expeditions again, and you guessed it, it was empty. And since then, I've never bought one of those again. Just saying. It may never happen to you. It may never happen to you. But I don't feel good about them. There's blue barrels that are food grade, made of HDPE plastic that Stephen Harris recommends for fuel storage, and I completely agree, and you can get them in 5 gallons and up to 15 gallons that are pretty manageable that you can wrestle around, and if long as they didn't store something you don't want to do with water, not only are they great for storing fuel, but you can store water in them because that's what they're generally for in the first place. I think they're a much better product. Those are tough as nails, and they don't break down. But they're still going to have stale water in them. They're still going to have stale water in them. Anyway, let's take another call.
Hi, Jack. This is Andrew from West Michigan with a news story I heard this weekend. I believe it was the Congressional Black Caucus is nominating or saying that one of your favorite politicians, Ms. Sheila Jackson Lee, should be the new director of Homeland Security since big sis Janet Napolitano is retiring or resigning. Just wonder what your thoughts are on that and how that would change things, being that she's irrelevant as a congressperson, but in a situation like her with a job as Homeland Security Director, you know, has a lot more ability to implement draconian laws and policy. Love to hear your thoughts on it. Take care, Jack. Bye.
You know, it was so funny. I had my little rant about Sheila Jackson Lee and how irrelevant she is. And it was like that day that the Congressional Black Caucus came out with a recommendation that she be considered for Homeland Security. Do you know what a recommendation from the Congressional Black Caucus that you be considered for a cabinet post is worth? If you had that and about $4, you could buy a big cup of Starbucks coffee. I'm just saying. Not because, and it's not a racial thing, it's not because they're the Black Caucus, it's because it would be true of many caucuses in the House or even in the Senate. This is how this works, okay? So you have somebody that is known for being useless, but you like to pretend that she's useful, and you like to give her status. So you and all your friends that are part of this caucus get together, and this, again, it's nothing to do with being black. If anybody says that, you're going to make me want to punch you in the face, because this could be the, you know, small business caucus that would do something like this. These clowns do this all the time, right? So you decide you want notoriety for somebody, and so you all get together when a position's available that they kind of sort of might be considered for maybe in a million years or something, and you recommend them. You write a letter of recommendation and you put it to a vote and you formally say, we recommend this person for this. Well, I recommend Sean Hipskin for governor of Arkansas since he's running as a libertarian. It doesn't really mean anything. My recommendation is not going to get him elected or selected for something else, right? Okay, That's what you got there. So why would you do this? Because now you say was a candidate for. So now when she's running for re-election, if she ever gets challenged by anybody in that district that's just warped in the head, they keep sending this tool back to Congress, they can put in there, was a candidate for Director of Homeland Security. Experience you can trust. It's bullshit. It's meaningless. It doesn't matter. If Sheila Jackson Lee became Director of Homeland Security, would she go from irrelevant to relevant overnight and have a lot of influence? Absolutely. You couldn't get me to bet on that happening with million-to-one odds in my favor if she did. If I could put up a dollar, right, and if I won, I'd get $1 million. If I was betting on her to be Director of Homeland Security, I'd probably bet the other way because I would rather keep my dollar because it ain't going to happen. It's not a serious candidacy. She's not being considered by the administration. The Obama administration is not considering her for anything. She's a useful idiot to the Democratic Party. This is just more paint on the marketing that is the empty pantsuit of Sheila Jackson Lee. Okay? And again, if anybody makes that about the fact that this lady's black, you deserve a good punch in the face. It has nothing to do with that. This is a worthless congressperson who's never accomplished anything and still hasn't. In some ways, actually, I'd like to thank Sheila Jackson Lee for that. The less a congressperson accomplishes in general, the less harm they've done to our nation. And in that reality, you know, I actually have to say, Sheila Jackson Lee's a pretty good congressperson. Will her district continue to reelect her? Because having a person in Congress who accomplishes nothing, from my perspective as a libertarian, it's actually a very good thing. But any of you that like found irony in that and thought it was a serious consideration for the job, it's not being considered for the job. It would be like, let's say you came to me and said, Jack, I want to get hired by IBM. And I want a board-level position with them. I want to be their new CEO. It's a high-status position, right? And I'm in business, and I have some business influence. I even know some people at IBM. I actually know some IBM execs, right? So there's a little bit of influence here. But if I write you a letter of recommendation for CEO of IBM, that letter's not worth the paper it's printed on. Let's just be honest. That's what the Congressional Black Caucus just did for Sheila Jackson Lee. Let's take another call.
Hello, my question is about the Texas Prepper Greenhouse, and my concern is ground contamination due to the materials I'll be using to build it. I plan on making my greenhouse 4 cattle panels long, which is about 16 feet. I have railroad ties that will be used as the base for my greenhouse that I'll secure my cattle panel to. This greenhouse will butt up to my 20 by 20 outdoor garden, which I have plants planted in ground. The greenhouse plants will be in containers or boxes, and I'm curious as to whether the railroad ties will leach into the ground and affect my plants that are in my outdoor garden that are in-ground plants. These railroad ties came from a rail station in Northern California. I assume they're about 60 years old. They probably have the real nasty stuff in them. Any thoughts would be great. Thanks. Bye.
If they're 60 years old, the amount of creosote that could leak out of them into your soil is probably minimal. It may be or it may not. I've seen old ties that, you know, they're spent. The thing is, when they're like that old and they're that spent of creosote, they're generally not going to last as long as they would if they were treated. Now, another thing I've also seen is a lot of times when ties are sold on the secondary market, they're retreated with creosote. And I've seen railroad ties, including some that were on my property, that are no longer on my property. When they get hit with the sun for a while, I've seen the stuff just weep out. And it's tar. It's a distillate, a tar distillate. Some's oil tar, some's coal tar, some's wood tar. But it's a tar distillate. It's basically a petroleum product. And it is toxic. There's no doubt about the fact that it's toxic. And it's not really conducive to growing stuff. I mean, nobody would mix tar in with their soil as a soil amendment. I mean, it's just not good. I would shy away from using them. As old as you say they are, if you really want to, you can. I know why you would. They're very heavy, and it's going to make a very stable base for your greenhouse, and that's probably what you're thinking. And I understand that, but the Greenhouse Texas Prepper advocates, and we're going to be building one or maybe two here on the homestead very soon, is designed to be built with, you know, 2x4s and 2x6s and stuff like that. And it's very stable. It's not going anywhere. And it's actually an advantage that you can move it if you want to. You kind of build it on skids. If you wanted something on the ground that was a little less likely to break down on you, I would say go with CCA-treated landscape timbers. Oh, no, it's pressure-treated. You know what? We've been through this before. Unlike creosote, CCA, which does contain copper and arsenic, is very stable in the wood. It takes a very, very long time to leach out, which is why they last so long. And the amounts of it that end up in soil are very benign, and a ton of testing's been done, and very little actually ends up in the soil, and even less ever ends up in a plant. And I've used it for years, and plenty of organic gardeners have used them to build raised beds, and no one has ever proven any problems with CCA-treated landscape timbers that can be measured or tested in any way. So I'm a lot more comfortable with that. And you might be thinking, but I have these four railroad ties. And then I would have to go out and buy, you know, four landscape timbers. Because 16 feet, two of them are 8 feet long. You get, you know. I think they sell for about $350 a piece at Lowe's and Home Depot. I'm just saying personally, I would use them before I'd use railroad ties. There's only a few railroad ties left on my property, and if my neighbor that I gave all the other ones to don't want them, I'll be giving them away to somebody. I personally don't like creosote on my property. I don't like the way that it often eventually leaches out of even ties that you think are clean. Eventually you get a really hot day or something, you go out and you just get this black gook weeping out. If they're really 60 years old, it probably isn't going to happen. You can do it. If you did it and I went to your house and I saw it there and you had a bed of carrots next to it and you made a bunch of carrots with sage and butter that night, grilled that I love, and said, would you eat these, Jack? Well, you know, would I turn up my nose and go, oh, no, you have this disgusting railroad tie here. I could see this and I will not pollute my body with that. No, I would be very happy to eat your carrots with hopefully a big old steak or something next to it. But if I had the choice and I hadn't done something already and it wasn't already there and I could decide what I was going to do in the beginning the way you can, I would much rather go out and spend, you know, $10-15 and build this with landscape timbers than I would want to build it with creosote-soaked railroad ties. I would maybe find another, you know, retaining wall application somewhere where it's not really going to interfere with any edibles or something. And honestly, I've kind of put railroad ties into that wrong answer camp, but just for me, and I don't feel that they're a horrible thing that should be banned or anything like that. Just if I have a choice, I'm going to use something else. Let's take another call.
Hey, Jack, I found a book, and since we're all ants, I just want to let you know about the ant philosophy. An ant never quits or gives up. The ant thinks of winter all summer. The ant thinks of summer all winter. Ants don't just gather enough and stop. They gather all they can. I just thought you'd like to hear it. Thanks a lot.
I'm putting that there as one of the top 10 coolest moments in all of TSP. If you're a new listener, you may have thought it was cool but not really get it. John is a longtime listener and caller of the show. He's like a fixture at TSP. It wouldn't be the same without him. We love John from West Virginia. I even killed him in the zombie spoof we did for Halloween one year. Very few people I would kill off in a zombie spoof unless I really love them. And I'm not going to say much else because that just stands through itself. John, I want you to know this too. When I screen calls today, I see, and I won't say your last name, but I see your name on the caller ID, and I know who you are every time now when I see your name and WV and the caller ID on the calls. And you've got a bunch in there. Like, I guess my spur on, hey, we miss you, give us some more calls. When I heard this one, John, I saved it. I put it in the queue for today. I didn't even listen to your other calls. I know where they're at. I have them in their own folder. I'll be peppering them through episodes for the next few weeks. I'm not ignoring your other calls, but you, brother, you cannot top that today. And I want everybody to know this. You know that little saga music that was playing in the background? John did that. I didn't do that. That was awesome, man. Thank you. Let's take another call.
This is for Jack Spearco. My name's Tom from Naples, Florida. Reference Bix Weir, who is an economist analysis guy and believes he's got it all figured out, believes that within 2 months, maybe three, our economy will completely implode. The Federal Reserve will no longer exist. The Federal Reserve notes will become worthless. A new currency will be initiated, and all debt as we know it, whether it be personal, corporate, or governmental, will be completely eliminated so that our economy can start out on an even slate with no debt. Right now, our biggest problem in the world is that we're the biggest debtor nation in the world. Question for you, Jack. You had mentioned, you know, years ago, because I've been a long-time listener, get out of debt, save money, buy assets. What do you think, based on Bix Weir hypothesis, do we go ahead and I'm debt-free? I've got two homes, boats, and that kind of stuff. Do I want to go ahead and get second mortgages, take that money that still has some value today, buy gold and silver, and then wait for the big reset? Give me your thoughts. Thank you very much. Enjoy your show.
I think this guy's a moron who said this a bunch of times in the past. Okay? That's what I think. I think you should stop listening to people that keep putting deadlines down and telling you stupid shit like go into debt and buy a bunch of assets and wait for the dollar to collapse. I think the people that tell you the Federal Reserve won't exist in 2 months are full of shit. This guy's an ass clown. Look at the man. You know what? You asked me, and I don't want anybody else that listens to this idiot to get hurt, so I gave you an answer. But that's it. That's the whole answer. There is no more answer. I'm not even going to entertain the concept. If I thought the collapse was really coming, would I advise this strategy? That's a subject for another day. Because this person is so ridiculous and has been so wrong so many times, there's no reason to give them any credence. And my answer is, the man is an ass clown. Don't listen to him. Next call.
Hey, Jack, this is John, North Carolina. I was just wondering what you might do with some non-flowering fruit trees. I've got some Yoshino cherries, and they're about 12 years old, and I hate to waste them. I was wondering if it would be a good idea maybe to graft producing fruit tree branches into it, or if I should just grow grapevines on it, or if it's just not worth the hassle, just rip it out and put something else in that actually produces fruit. My concern, I guess, with grafting would be that since it's a fruit producing, just a flowering, would that somehow affect whatever I would graft to it? But appreciate your comment. Thanks.
Actually, I think you've proposed your own best solution, and I'll tell you why. If you cut the tree down and plant a new tree and you don't like the results, you've made a decision that's not reversible. If you pick a few places and do some grafting of some fruiting cherries onto an existing cherry tree and the grafts don't take, you can still cut the tree down. It makes sense. You can cut it down, but you can't put it back. You can not cut it down and still cut it down later. Does that make sense? And I think that if you have a root system of a tree that's 12 years old, stable, I think it's a great idea. I'd love to operate. If there was a non-fruiting tree in this yard that was a good candidate for grafting, I'd be all over it. And you could graft multiple varieties. And as far as the fact that it's a flowering cherry, all it's going to do is increase your pollinization. as long as they're good pollinators back and forth for each other. It certainly isn't going to hurt anything. The regular flowers will at least attract other pollinators. So I think it's a great idea. I think you should do it. I'd love to hear back from you on how it works as far as where. This is something to talk to. You're going to have to buy, you know, some wood to graft, right? So talk to some people that do that and say, where, how much, et cetera. Because the danger is how much of the tree do you do this with without kind of disrupting its growth patterns. But honestly, you could probably graft most of the tips, right? I mean, so it's something I've never done, but I know it works. I've seen the Bullock brothers do it with apples, taking wild-growing crab apple and grafting cultivated apple varieties onto it and get very good results. And I believe they've done it with cherry. I believe they've grafted fruiting cherries onto basically like a choke cherry or something like that. And, you know, I'm feeling dumb. I'm just thinking of all the black cherry, wild black cherry that was in Arkansas. And that opportunity was there, and I never saw it. So I think it's a great idea. I think you should give it a shot. And I think if it doesn't work, you can make cutting the tree down and replacing it plan B. And that's a much better option than cutting the tree down and the day after you do it going, man, I really wish I wouldn't have done that. You got to think about the time you do it. And I would get with someone that provides grafting supplies and grafting material and tell them what you have planned and get some professional advice on this one. But it's a great, easy first step into grafting. And let's face it, the consequences of failure are not very great. When you're going to take a risk, if you can take a risk with a great reward and a low risk of failure or a low penalty of failure, give it a shot, man. Let us know how it works. I really would love to hear back from you. If in the spring, this coming year, in 2014, you have grafted fruiting cherry budding on an ornamental cherry, I'd love to hear about that. If anybody's done this, please weigh in and give us some more information on it, because it's something I haven't personally been able to do yet. Take care. Thanks for the call, and let's take another one.
Hey, Jack. This is Harlan Lowat living on the forum. My question is, my wife can shoot our 10/22 very well, but she has a problem with the AR-15, which has a fixed position stock. She can't seem to get it set up where it feels right on her. Should I take her to a local gun dealer for them to fit her with something, or should I just measure the stock of the 10/22 and try to set that up on the AR-15, or we just can't seem to get it to feel right for her. Thank you very much.
I don't want the initial thing I'm going to say to be taken wrong. Please understand, I don't know you. I don't know if what I'm saying is true, but I have a hunch this could at least be possible, that neither of you actually know the proper way to shoot an AR-15. And the reason I say this is, when I watch people shoot ARs that have never been in the military and never been taught how to get up on an AR, how to get that nose up on the charging handle, right up behind that rear sight, they almost never do. They shoot an AR like a typical sporting rifle. Okay, so the first issue may be that what you're thinking feels right is not the right way to shoot an AR. And shooting an AR is not like shooting a 10/22 or a Model 700. I have a hard time thinking it's a length of pull issue. And here's why. Most ARs with a fixed length stock have a length of pull of about 13.25 to 13.75 inches. Most of them are right at 13.5, depending on maybe the buttstock and if there's a recoil pad or a plate back there, depending on who makes it. But it's almost inevitable that you're looking at a 13.5 inch length of pull on an AR. The length of pull on a Ruger 10/22 stock out of the box, unless it's a youth model, is 13.5 inches. It's the same. I'm not saying there's no ARs with a different length of pull. I'm just saying. Now, the easy answer, if it is indeed length of pull, get a collapsible buttstock so that you can adjust it. That's the easy answer. But the first question I have is, are you shooting an AR the way it's designed to be shot, and does the AR have optics? Because this could be another problem altogether. There's a lot of people out there that I see that have ARs with the carry handle style peep sight situation. So you've got your raised sights, and they have an optic mounted on top of the carry handle. This makes shooting that AR very difficult to get into good form because you're bringing your head way too high up on that stock, and that stock is not, it's like trying to shoot a scoped bolt action rifle that doesn't have a cheek piece with, let's say, medium high rings on it. It just isn't right. You can't get the cheek weld down. So that's another possibility. Assuming you're shooting this with either iron sights or a flat top mounted optic, where you can get your head right on the stock, it really may be a great idea if you could go get somebody with military training to walk through proper shooting of the AR-15 platform with you. I know there's people out there right now that think I'm being a dick, that think I'm being arrogant. And again, I don't know you. You may have spent 10 years in the military and you may know exactly what I'm saying. And if you have, you know what I'm saying is true, and I'm talking to the caller now, right? And maybe it is just a fit issue. The reason I doubt that is every week soldiers go through in the Army what's called BRM, or Basic Rifle Marksmanship, and every soldier shoots a rack grade M16, or I guess today it's M4s. When I was in, it was M16s. We actually were being issued A2s, and we were shooting and training A1s, the old Vietnam-era ones, except for differences in the handguard, two styles of handguard. They're all rack-grade rifles. They were all the same. Men and women drew the same weapons and shot the same weapons. Men shot those weapons that were 6'6", and women shot those weapons that were 5'2". And everybody that was taught the proper form was able to be effective with that weapon. Very few people actually fail basic rifle qualification in the military. And the ones that do, generally, you work with them a little bit and they get through it. I've saw very few people actually recycled and kicked back a week in training to another platoon over this. In fact, I'd say in the company I went through, it didn't happen to anybody. Right? Now, I don't know if it's more common with females, but my point is that thousands of troops a week literally qualify on the same stock weapons. And if it's changed, and if you guys have adjustable pull length M4s in basic now, I don't know that. I haven't been in the Army since 1993. Doesn't matter, because for years and years it was true, which means there's probably not a problem with the weapon. And I came from a background of being very sure of myself when it came to my ability with a rifle when I got in the Army. And we had drill sergeants that said right away, I don't care how good or bad you think you are with a weapon. I don't care how much experience you have or you don't have. This is the Army. We're going to teach you to shoot the Army way. Do what we say and forget what you know. Now, that's all good and well, and there are certain things that are intrinsic to being a good rifleman that if you grew up hunting deer and squirrels, they're not going to go away. But the head position, you would never fire any sporting rifle with your head up onto the bolt the way you do with your nose in contact with that charging handle on an AR. You would never do it. You would never, ever be in that position. So it won't feel right if right is supposed to be the same, if that makes sense. If you know what I'm doing and you're trying to teach her to shoot this way and it's still a problem, it could be a mental issue. It could be that doesn't feel the same, so it's wrong, and you might have to get her over that. It could be length of pull. She could be a shorter person or something like that, and maybe it is. And then just change it, right? But if neither of you has ever shot and been professionally trained to shoot an AR-style weapon, and what I'm saying doesn't really add up, it doesn't really make sense, go find someone who has and get their experience. And I'm going to tell you, this is rampant. I don't know how many police officers who have shown me their AR-15s, and you know, whenever you're talking, you put the weapon up, and I look at the head position. And I'm not talking about the head being upright and the cheek weld. I'm talking about how far up on the stock the head is. And the head's 4 inches back from the breech. And I'm sorry, that's not how you shoot an AR. And it's a different weapon than just about anything out there. And it is best shot the way that it was designed to be shot. And I know some people are going to be angry with me about this, but I didn't make up the Army way. And every Marine I've ever watched pick up an AR, man, it's the same thing. I don't know about you Air Force guys and Navy guys. I haven't been out shooting a lot of ARs with you, but I've shot a lot of ARs with a lot of prior service Army and prior service Marines, and we all shoot it the same way. And I'd start there. But if it's just a stock issue, just replace it. Now, if you live in a state that won't allow that, you're going to have to find a fixed-length stock that fits her. You may be able to find there are some stocks that have basically like a removable plate. It's not a collapsible, so you can change the length of pull. But it doesn't make the weapon as universal back and forth anymore. Anyway, again, if I've offended anybody with this answer, I'm sorry. But I don't make the rules when it comes to stuff like this. I just follow them. Let's take another call. Actually, guys, you know what? That's it. We've wrapped up another show. I thought I had one more call in the queue, but I don't. I think it is more than time to wrap up. Now we're out close to the 2-hour mark with the show on a Friday, as typical for it. If you want to be on a show like this again, 866-65-THINK. Again, 866-65-THINK. Remember what I talked about in the beginning of today's show. If you want to be part of what MT Knives is doing and become a stakeholder in MT Knives and get involved with that and be part of the creation of a new American company and help a really great guy get started and receive a return of your investment on this and have something that's going to last a lifetime, get over to mtknives.net and check out the program, or go to thesurvivalpodcast.com, check out the show notes, and I'll have a link there for you. I do think that program, this is not marketing, I do think that program is going to sell out the day we launch it. I think it's going to be awesome, and I'm really proud. If you can't tell, I'm really proud to be part of it. It makes me feel good. I want to say a little bit here at the end. We've been through some stuff lately with things I won't even bring up, and mud gets slung all the time. And the reality is, I made a promise to you guys from the very beginning, especially those of you who have been listening since I was in my car going up and down the Dallas-Fort Worth freeways doing this show on a $20 recorder, that I said, number one, if you'll come along with me and help me out, I'll make this a success. And I promise I'll make it something you're proud of. And I also promised that I would give back. And over the years, I've tried to do so. This thing with MT Knives is no different. I'm not a super shareholder or something like that. I don't have any greater stake than the other 99 people that would buy a knife. I'm just number one, which I'm kind of proud of, having that first edition, first knife, and already wearing it around my neck. But this is giving back. And this isn't, I get people sometimes, I would have this great business if you could just, recommend me or whatever. And it's not that simple. I can't just turn on success for a person. But this is a person that's worked really hard for years, for a long time, and perfected his craft and got himself into a position where he just needed that last piece. And he didn't even ask for it. He just told me what he was looking for, and because he's a good friend and because we have a long-term relationship, eventually my mind just kind of kicked in as to, well, here's how you can do that. And this is part of giving back. I said very early on that as you become more successful, it's important to look at doing things, and I don't like the word, but that are almost what we normally think of as a charity. And I think philanthropy is a better word. And that there were times that didn't mean 501c36 and write a check. That meant leveraging your capital, your social capital, or your capital, your financial capital, whatever it was, to help somebody. And maybe that wasn't even a nonprofit thing. That was just like it was a good thing to do. I really feel that way about Patrick and Emily Rohrman and their wonderful children and MT Knives. And again, folks, you want to come on that journey with me? I think that's one that we'll be looking back at 10 years from now going, it was profitable and it was the right thing to do. And I don't believe for a second, the way that many try to make it, that those two things are mutually exclusive. With that, this has been Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough, or even if they don't.
Sometimes we forget we are what we eat. I don't know the answer. It's like there's nothing I can do. It price we pay, I guess, when we follow all the rules. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way. Nobody up.